Welcome to our podcast for Raising Arizona Kids Magazine. I'm Vicki Belind. This month, Gilbert pediatrician Dale Guthrie, MD, begins a two-year term as board president of the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. A father of six and grandfather to eight, he talks about a hip injury that led him to pediatrics, the long-term impact of a mission trip in Central America, the business of healthcare, and what parents of special needs kids need to know.
I'm Dale Guthrie. I'm the incoming president of the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, fourth generation native Arizonan, married for 32 years, six children, and eight grandchildren.
So, Dr. Guthrie, let's talk a little bit about the earliest memories that you have of visiting the doctor yourself.
Very interesting, because my parents didn't really believe in doctors very much, and so I only went in when I was sick. And I had a sinus infection, I can remember one time, and was in. And then I had a very serious pediatric, rare pediatric hip disorder when I was a late teenager, that then I had to get some intervention with.
So you didn't really grow up knowing doctors that well.
Nope, I'm the first physician in our family, and so I didn't really know them very well.
So what inspired you to become a physician?
Probably the incident or that episode in my life where, you know, I was playing basketball, didn't know I had this hip problem. My hip dislocated and broke, and some really wonderful people came to my assistance, and Dr. Wilson and Mesa, I'll be forever indebted to him, and he's taken care of me even till now. He's stayed involved in my hip care. I've had four operations on that right hip, including a hip replacement. I really enjoyed orthopedics, but again, it just didn't turn out to be what I wanted to do. But I think that probably influenced me most.
How did you select pediatrics?
I fell in love with it. The nice thing about medical school is you don't just get on one track and go through and stick to it. You get through medical school, you do all your rotations, and you find out what you like. And when I did my pediatric rotations, I just fell in love with taking care of kids.
So you went to medical school in Juarez. We talked about that, and that's across the border from El Paso. What was that like for you? Were the classes in Spanish? Different culture.
Yes, different culture, but for me, it wasn't a big difference because I had already served a two-year LDS mission in Central America.
What country, have to ask?
Costa Rica, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama.
Yeah.
And so for me, I was a fluent Spanish speaker. In fact, that's probably why I kept that option open to be able to go to Mexico. It was at a time where I felt like my chances were not that great of getting into American medical school. And had a friend who was going down there, and we went and checked it out and felt good about it.
What are some of your memories of starting there and seeing patients and studying? You were used to the culture and speaking Spanish, but here now you had to study medicine.
It was very different. The kids who go to medical school in Mexico are right out of prep school, so they basically are just out of high school. So we were a little older than they and a little more focused. They were playing games at school. They were initiating the new freshmen by cutting their hair and doing some, you know, things that were kind of juvenile. And yet they were good students, and I made friends with a lot of them. Our school basically only had students from America to bolster their budget. It was a national, it's a state school in Juarez. And so there were only 15 in each class who were from America, and the rest of the big group was from Mexico. So we got to know some of them really well. And I do keep in touch with a few here and there, and it's a different life for them for sure.
Can you point to any of the ways that you may have benefited from that experience that you may not have expected?
You know, I think more than being in Mexico, being on a mission and in Central America and seeing little kids, and no matter what their circumstance, and just feeling drawn to them. You know, little boys asking for a drinky or soda pop, and then and you see the little backwash they just left in it and say, yeah, you can just have that. But I really felt tied to people. Just then it taught me that everybody's important, no matter where you're born, no matter what circumstances, that you're an important human being.
So what's your biggest concern about children's health issues today?
My biggest concern is access to care. I think children having access to a quality medical home. And I don't think that's all financial. I think there are financial pressures. I think there are government pressures. There are cultural pressures. There are community pressures, society, where we just can't get the right number of doctors. And there are insurance pressures where, you know, we have to make sure everything in this country is always the cheapest, the most affordable. And so there are things like minute clinics cropping up, and that may be a good thing for some people. It's not a good thing for pediatrics. And I don't mean to just single them out. It's a wide variety of issues. But anything that draws a child out of his or her medical home where he or she knows who their pediatrician is, and that pediatrician knows their medical history, they know their vaccine record, they know everything about them, that decreases the quality of care. They can't get in that situation. And frankly, not all kids have that option.
Could you give an example of how a child might be affected if they, say, didn't have a medical home? Could something be missed?
Easy. I mean, the easiest probably is if they don't have a vaccine card, they don't have their immunization card, and they just are somewhere or not being followed in a medical home. And no one knows, and then they're exposed to a vaccine-preventable disease. They could be killed or maimed by that. But also the other things with just knowing, you know, this kiddo has seizures, or he has diabetes, or he has asthma. What medicines is he on? All those kinds of things that you roll into a place that doesn't know you, and the care is going to be fragmented.
So how has the role of pediatrician changed or evolved since you started practicing?
You know, it has changed a lot. For a person in my position, for some pediatricians, it hasn't changed at all. If they're in academic pediatrics or they practice in a government setting or something like that. Hi, bud. But for private practice pediatrics where you're running a business, it has become harder and harder to make ends meet, to control vaccine costs and to manage the business side of practice. And the more time I have to devote to that, the less time I can devote to what I really love doing, and that's taking care of the kids. And so that's why, you know, the political pressures and everything. I love the changes with Obamacare that say, yeah, we're going to cover every child. But on the other side, I'm ambivalent about what it's going to do to me as a small business owner. And if I'm not there, if I can't keep my doors open, then I can't take care of these kids. So I'm stretched.
What is it that families perhaps don't understand about managing vaccines in the pediatric practice?
What most people think is that all physicians are very rich and that it doesn't matter and shouldn't matter. Anything about cost to a business practice in medicine shouldn't matter. But the thing is that in Arizona, we've had two pediatric practices in the last 2 years that went out of business because they came to the end of a few months and they didn't realize that insurance companies were not compensating them even for the cost of their vaccines. And when, as in our office, we have at any given time about 125,000 in vaccines and two refrigerators and two offices. If you can't keep track of that and the way that the companies are compensating you for that, you could lose your shirt, you know, soon. And that's what these two practices did. And then there are other really good pediatric practices, and even in the valley here, it seems unthinkable, but they've stopped giving vaccines. One of the mainstays, the most important thing we could do in child health and vaccine and preventing disease. And some pediatricians are saying, I can't do it. I can't afford to keep that vaccine in the fridge, wondering whether I'm going to be paid for it. So I think that parents, I mean, I talk about it sometimes if they ask me, but I always feel kind of funny about it because you know, I'm a doctor. And so they just kind of assume, yeah, you're rich. They don't understand, I guess, also that pediatricians, and I'm not crying about it, but we're at the low end of the pay scale. We are at the bottom of all physicians. There are physicians, surgeons, and others who, I don't bemoan what they make, but they probably make 7 or 8 times what I make in a year. And they don't have to worry about overhead and managing costs and things. And so I think that's what people may not understand. And that's why we're fighting for some of the recognition and the help from the government, from the state government right now with the vaccine compensation issues.
So let's talk a bit about your role as board president coming up. How do you see your role in a nutshell? What are your interests that you'd like to work on while you're serving?
Well, I have a lot of specific interests. For probably 20 years, I've been the tobacco, alcohol, drug-free generation coordinator for the chapter. And so for me, substance abuse issues are important. I have 2 special needs children, my wife and I do, of our own. And so special needs and developmental delay and autism and those things are very important to me. We you know, obesity, our obesity committee, I haven't been involved with that committee, but we have been, our committee has just been absolutely active. And practice management issues. I've served on the pediatric council for 3 or 4 years now too, and that's the business of pediatrics. And so I guess my role would probably, I see my role as president not as saying this is what my one agenda issue and I'm going to push it. I think it's my role to continue keeping everything going, because all of our committees are really important. We have advocacy committee that works with the legislature, and we have a young physicians committee. We have a lot of outreach committees, and they do wonderful work. So I think I probably would try to elevate each one of those, or at least make sure they know that they're each important. We need to have all the spokes in the wheel, you know, attached and running.
So let's talk a little bit about your own family. Lots of kids.
Yeah.
The 2 youngest, though, in particular, tell me their names and their special needs.
So my wife, Jo, and I have had 5 daughters in a row by birth. They're our birth kids. And our first 4 daughters are typical, although sometimes I wonder about that. But by nation standards, they'd be typical. They're actually really good kids. They're all married. And then Candace was born a little bit premature after a very difficult pregnancy, and she's 21 years old now, had severe developmental delay and is nonverbal. And about age 3 or 4, back then autism was not, it was different. It was looked at differently. In fact, one child psychiatrist when she was young said she definitely does not have autism. But then she now has that diagnosis and learns really a lot better in an autism-type classroom. And so she's gone through Gilbert Schools, has had wonderful teachers. Her teacher at Highland High this year is awesome. And if you're a kiddo with special needs, you get to go to school until your 22nd birthday and then finish out the year. So she has she's 21. She has 1 more year of high school. So she's going to be over at Highland 1 more year. Our youngest is Will, and Will he's adopted, and he's 14. He has a really rare chromosome disorder, and in fact, when he was diagnosed, they told me there were 2 of reported, and now it's up to about 10.
2 in the world?
Yes, and so he's a very unique kiddo. Will is doing right well. You just saw him walk by. He just completed his Eagle Scout Border Review, and so he will be getting that pretty soon. And he's an ASU fanatic, because I am, but in his own right. So when he got his braces off his teeth after 3 long, painful years of that, a week ago today, we arranged to take him over and to meet the head football coach, the new one at ASU. So Coach Todd Graham was very gracious and had a little conversation with Will, and but that's our group. And then we've got all these grandkids, so they're wonderful, wonderful kids.
What kind of, I don't want to say tips, but What words of wisdom would you pass on to young families that are raising kids with special needs? You've kind of done the five typical kids first, and then later in life, plus your pediatrician, mm-hmm. you must have some wisdom that you could share.
I do. I occasionally, there's a family that comes into my practice and they're escaping another pediatric practice because, not that there was a bad pediatrician, but they didn't feel like they got, they feel like, oh, I heard about Dr. Guthrie and he's got two special needs kids, and so maybe he'll have more empathy or sympathy for my situation. Most of those times, it's interesting that those families are still kind of feeling sorry for themselves, for the bad hand that they were dealt. And so that my advice in that setting initially is, in a very soft way, we need to leave that. You can grieve as long as you need to for the loss of a normal child. That is a normal grieving process. But you need to focus on that child, and if you have other children, move ahead and be positive. And so, and then from there, it is extremely important that a special needs child and any child have two sane parents. And so it's, to me, you can only do what you can do. And there will be people coming out of the woodwork. I mean, I should be a pediatrician telling them, you got to do this therapy and this therapy, but I'm not that way. I'm going to say, you pray about it. You see what your intuition tells you. You know that child better than anyone else. So when they line up speech, physical therapy, occupational therapy, music therapy, equine therapy, and all the others, you can say, you know, I only have this much time, or I'm not going to be able to parent my other kids. And so, or even give this child the parenting that she needs. So I think making sure that parents know that they have flexibility to do what they think is best for that child. No one knows them better. And then also that they're not alone. There are all kinds of people, even if you have the rarest chromosome disorder on the face of the earth, there's somebody who's dealing with something pretty similar to you and who's been through it. There's somebody who has had to sit and for years with repetition toilet train an autistic child by just doing it for 6 or 7 years straight. That's our family. And finally, it worked. And so there are people out there who can help you. And raising special kids, and there are some other genetic, some groups that can help people too. So you're not alone.
So what if all of your children, taught you about fatherhood?
So I think the typical ones have taught me that they're different. And that they each needed something a little bit different. And some of them, two of them easily were very easy to raise. And I hope they don't read this article, because the other two may feel that, no, they know.
But there are actually always two in there.
The others are great. I mean, they've turned out really well. But they taught me how to be a better parent. And I think that's kind of why one of the reasons we come to Earth, is to learn that. The other thing that those typical kids have taught me is that they can love an atypical sibling, no matter what their difference is. And I've watched them just nurture. Even when they're quibbling with each other, they're taken care of, and like a hen gathers her chicks, they're really taking, they love those kids. And they've been really good for them. The kids with the special needs, they just teach us that they're important and that we need to stay on our toes and continue to help them when they learn something new. And sometimes it's a good thing, and sometimes they need to be redirected. And just to have hope. And again, know that they're important no matter what their difference is.
Read more in our July issue, where you'll find out how to stock an I'm Bored box for kids on summer vacation, plus recipes for cool summer treats and lunchbox pleasers. Find us on the web at RaisingArizonaKids.com. I'm Vicki Belint. Thanks for listening.
Raising Arizona Kids Radio is a Small Change production. All rights reserved. This material may not be broadcast or redistributed without permission.